Good afternoon. I'd like to call House Judiciary Committee meeting to order. Today is Wednesday, April 26th, and let the record reflect that it is 1:09 p.m. Today we have present Representative Eastman, Representative Gray, Vice Chair Allard, and myself, Chair Vance. I would like to remind committee members and those in the audience to please silence your cell phones. Staff assisting us today is Sophia Tenney with House Records and Kelsey Riker with the Juneau LIO. Thank you for your work. The committee will hear House Bill 181, State Commission for Civil Rights, or currently the State Commission for Human Rights by the House Judiciary Committee. So we will now take up House Bill 181, and I would like to invite my committee aide, Jake Almeida, to walk us through the bill.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jake Almeida, Chief of Staff to Rep Vance. Before you is House Bill 181. This is a bill by this committee, the House Judiciary Committee. This bill incorporates a number of changes that were requested by the State Commission for Human Rights. And I will just briefly walk the committee through a sectional about what those changes are. So Section 1 is a big policy change for the bill. We're renaming the commission, the State Commission for Human Rights, to the now Alaska State Commission for Civil Rights. Section 2, we're amending AS 1880-020 by allowing the governor to remove any commissioner from serving on the commission for causes such as incompetence, neglect of duty, misconduct in office, public statements, and public or private actions that would undermine the commission's work. That there's not an existing avenue for that, so that is why the addition is in this bill. Section 3 amends AS 1880-060A by ensuring the commission's assessments regarding progress toward equal employment opportunities are done once every 3 years and are summarized in a report within 90 days of the legislature convening and will be available electronically and to the public. Section 4 amends AS 1880-150 to direct the commission to complete its annual report for the preceding year's data on civil rights problems that the commission dealt with to be done by November 15th of each year, and again make that report electronically available and notifying the legislature and the governor. Existing statute just says the legislature. Section 5 amends AS 1880-29A, making a conforming change for municipalities of the commission's name change. And Section 7 deals with the definition of employer and clarifying that employer does not include nonprofits, associations, social or fraternal entities under AS 1020-005, religious associations and religious corporations under AS 1040-010, and for-profit religious organizations under AS 1050-010. And then sections 8 through 11 just make conforming changes regarding the name change of the commission. And before the committee should be a number of resolutions that pertain to the commission making those decisions to recommend changes in statute and for questions as to why the commission wants to make these changes. We have the executive director for the Human Rights Commission, Mr. Rob Corbusier. So I will leave it to the will of the committee for any questions.
Mr. Corbusier, if you could just walk us through your recommendations from the commission, the conversations that you had around the need for these changes, that would be helpful.
Absolutely. For the record, I'm Rob Corbusier, I'm the executive director for the Alaska State Commission for Human Rights. Let's start with the name change. We think the name is dated. The commission gets contacted by people routinely who do not know what we do. I'm not going to name names, but there are legislators and cabinet members who have also been confused by what we do based on our name. We think that the name probably was reflective of the era in the 40s, 50s, and 60s when human rights was the in vogue term as an outgrowth of World War II atrocities and the UN Universal Declaration on Human Rights in 1948. That declaration includes a lot of things that are completely irrelevant to the commission, such as criminal due process, the rights to privacy, travel, asylum, deprivation of property, freedom of speech, health, and education. And we do get people that will ask us, well, can't you do something about environmental causes? No, that is beyond the jurisdiction of the commission. We also routinely get asked about other criminal issues or humanitarian issues. Even after giving a presentation to my own Rotary Club, the Anchorage Downtown Rotary, I had someone ask me after the presentation if we could do anything about the homeless issue in Anchorage. And I had to say, well, homeless is not a protected class. This is literally after I just explained exactly what the commission does. There was some public confusion that occurred even this last summer with an event that the Alaska Humanities Forum was sponsoring. And there were people that contacted the governor's office to complain about the Human Rights Commission. The Human Rights Commission was the entity that was sponsoring or co-sponsoring that event, when in fact we had nothing to do with the event. The U.S. EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission, is a fairly well-understood government agency. And when you look at what it is that ASHRAE does, our existence, we are a function that is required by Article 1, Section 3 of the state constitution. That section is titled Civil Rights. The second sentence of that section states, the legislature shall enforce this section. The Human Rights Commission is the enforcement of that section. Elizabeth Peratovich quoted the Bill of Rights during her speech in the 1940s and became ASHRAE's current statute. We got federal legislation that was titled the Civil Rights Act in 1957. The 14th Amendment is titled the Equal Protection Clause. The commission believes that changing the name to align with modern linguistics would accomplish the mission of eliminating preventive discrimination. And to that extent, the commission did formally endorse during a vote last Monday the name, the Alaska State Commission for Civil Rights. So that is the name change. Let's talk about the annual report date.
Mr. Kabisa.
So, yes.
We do have a question from Vice Chair Howard.
Thank you, and through the chair. So when I'm reading, have you read the definition, the legal definition, or the definition of human rights?
The state does not have a definition for human rights.
Have you looked up the definition of human? Thank you. Through the chair, have you looked up the definition of human rights anywhere outside of the state's not having a definition?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, I mean, I've reviewed the UN Universal Declaration on Human Rights.
Okay. So we're splitting hairs because basically human rights and civil rights almost mean the same thing. It just depends on which philosophy or which organization is giving a definition. Have you thought about how much this is going to cost to change it from civil rights to human rights? Because this has been brought up in the past to change it. You were advised not to do it, and now we're here again asking legally to change it. And I'm just trying to figure out. No, I've never heard of anybody misconstruing the title. So if you can just explain the cost associated with changing everything to civil rights versus leaving it at human rights.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Allard, we believe this would cost nothing. The website would need to get changed. Our future publications would need to get changed. There are two signs in the hallway of the building that would need to get changed. And we can absorb the cost of those two signs. Additionally, the agency is at the end of its lease. And so the commission wanted to explore doing an RFP. And the Department of Transportation statewide leasing officer is actually strongly encouraging us to simply take over an existing lease space in another area that would still require a build-out, and the build-out would be amortized, but it would ultimately be a net savings to the state. And I expect that signage could easily be amortized as part of the build-out when we move, assuming we end up moving. Either way, there ends up being a new RFP for we could deal with signage, but there's nothing else in particular that would cost us anything to change the name. An earlier iteration of the commission, certainly when you were on the commission, did advise me not to do that, but the discussion has come up with my current crop of commissioners, and they unanimously passed a resolution to change the name.
May I follow up? Thank you. I can give you three examples of civil liberties or civil rights: freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and guarantee a fair, unbiased trial. Where when you look at human rights, it says that you have rights, are rights that everyone has simply because they are human. Does the commission and the Alaska Human Rights Commission believe that everybody should be treated equally based on the fact that they're a human?
Absolutely. I mean, that's what's required by state law and the Constitution.
Madam Chair, I would be against changing the title of the organization. Thank you for allowing me to speak. Thank you.
Please, can Representative Eastman.
Thank you to the chair. I just to get some clarity, is this is through the chair. Do you believe that the civil rights would include things like election rights, voting rights? Are those civil rights?
Mr. Kabize, would you? I feel like we're getting away from the original mission, and I didn't ask you previously to begin outlining the human right, the mission, overall mission, and the duties as prescribed by statute for the commission. Would you please do that, and then you can answer Representative Eastman's question.
Absolutely. Let me pull up our statute. Give me 2 seconds here.
When you get a moment, can we take a
brief at ease? Back on the record, let the record reflect we have been joined by Representative Craig Johnson at 1:25 p.m. Mr. Kabize, please continue. We left off with you taking a brief moment to refresh yourself on the statutes, to give an overview of the authority for the Human Rights Commission and its mission. That would be greatly appreciated, and then concluding that with answering Rep. Eastman's question.
Sure. To the chair, AS 1880-200 is titled Purpose. Subsection A, it is determined and declared as a matter of legislative finding that discrimination against an inhabitant of the state because of race, religion, color, national origin, age, sex, physical or mental disability, marital status, changes in marital status, pregnancy or parenthood is a matter of public concern, and that this discrimination not only threatens the rights and privileges of the inhabitants of the state, but also menaces the institutions of the state and threatens peace, order, health, safety, and general welfare of the state and its inhabitants. Subsection B. Therefore, it is the policy of the state and the purpose of this chapter to eliminate and prevent discrimination in employment, in credit and financing practices, in places of public accommodation, in the sale, lease, or rental of real property because of race, religion, color, national origin, sex, age, physical or mental disability, marital status, changes in marital status, pregnancy, or parenthood. It is also the policy of the state to encourage and enable physically and mentally disabled persons to participate fully in the social and economic life of the state and to engage in remunerative employment. It is not the purpose of this chapter to supersede laws pertaining to child labor, the age of majority, or other age restrictions or requirements. The next section is AS 1880-210. It is not titled as a definition section, but it is titled Civil Rights. The opportunity to obtain employment, credit and financing, public accommodations, housing accommodations, and other property without discrimination because of sex, physical or mental disability, marital status, changes in marital status, pregnancy, parenthood, race, religion, color, or national origin is a civil right. And now I forgot what Representative Eastman's question was.
Representative Eastman, would you restate your question?
Through the chair. Yeah, I my question was, are voting rights a civil right?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, arguably they are, but they are not something that is covered by the Human Rights Commission. There are certainly aspects of voting rights that are civil rights. Voting is a fundamental right. And a government certainly cannot discriminate against a person based upon their membership in a protected class as it relates to voting. So, for example, even though it should have been confidential, it was certainly all over the news that the commission sued the Division of Elections because we believed the division was not providing a reasonable accommodation for blind and disabled voters by providing an all-by-mail ballot.
Follow up. Thank you. And I suppose if we're going to be making this change to the Civil Rights Commission as opposed to the Human Rights Commission, I'm sure some will look at that as a step towards expanding the commission's scope to include additional civil rights, you know, for example, voting rights. So I'm sure there's others as well. So is that the direction that the commission is hoping to go long term?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, no. And I would actually argue that by changing it to civil rights, it is actually restricting what it is that is encompassed within the name, because civil rights doesn't include things like the right to travel or asylum or, you know, freedom of speech, health, education. You know, those are all things that are within the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that ASHRAE does not cover.
Thank you.
Please continue, Mr. Kibizi. I think you've covered the name change. If you want to move on to the other aspects of the bill as requested by the commission.
Thank you. So let's move on to the annual report date. So when the commission was created in 1963 and it literally had no cases in the first year, maybe making the annual report due within the first week before you gavel in made sense every year. But things have changed a lot since 1963. This year, we would have had, according to statute, 5 business days to interpret and analyze all of our data for the prior year, write the vignettes, get the report to a layout editor, get it printed, physically print it, and deliver it to the legislative library. The statute also says we're only to deliver 40 copies, even though there are 60 legislators. The commission realizes this is an unrealistic deadline, and for the last 40 years has made little or no effort to actually try and meet that deadline. Since I've been executive director, I have tried really, really hard to meet that deadline and found it is simply impossible. Even if we have most of our vignettes written up and ready to go and we only have a few edits to make, it still takes time to make those edits, and we still have to go through our data from the last year. We don't have that data available until January 1. So we would like to have additional time. Now, so we passed resolution 2022-8, but during our time meeting with representatives and senators when we were in Juneau in February, a continuous theme came up that was, why don't you guys do this on the fiscal year? If you look at your data on the fiscal year and give us the report then in the interim, we'll actually have some time to look at it and read it, as opposed to at the beginning of the session when we're being inundated with reports. The other component of this is every 3 years per statute, we are required to do an annual assessment of the executive branch's progress on equal employment opportunity. Now, we like to take that time to sit down with members of the governor's cabinet and their HR business managers, their admin service people, whoever they want to bring, to look at each individual department's data. And we learn a lot about that because it becomes an informed report as opposed to just us looking at the data in a vacuum. And we've included and learned a lot of great information. For example, when last time we did this, we learned that Hess had a reduction in its female employees. And through the interview, we learned it's not because Hess fired a bunch of women. It was because they outsourced a lot of the Pioneer Home health provider services. And a lot of those were women. It's not that these women were just simply fired. They were all picked up by the contractors. But you see then a corresponding decrease in their EEO number for women. Kind of on the flip side of things, the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs had pretty great EEO numbers, and their numbers were getting better for looking at diversity. And the commissioner of DMVA said that, Adjutant General Sachs said that the Department of Defense has a policy that when you interview someone, you have to have a member of the person's race on the interview panel. And that then informs some of the views and statements that might be made during an interview and has increased DOD's numbers. And General Sachs said, I decided to implement that across the board for DMVA, including on all of our civilian jobs. And he believes that is one of the reasons, probably the primary driver, for why their EEO numbers look good in DMVA. So those interviews and those vignettes are important to us. But trying to get cabinet members to sit down the week before session starts to look at their own data when they've got budget priorities and legislative priorities, and it is not realistic. By moving the annual reports to a fiscal year data analysis that aligns them then with the fiscal year number one, by allowing us to give you the report on November 15th, that gives us like 4 months to produce the annual report, even in an assessment year, which is only every 3 years. And it would also then fall after the election date. So in an election year, we're going to know who the new legislators are. So in addition to notifying the existing legislators, we'll also be able to notify the new legislators about our report. So that is why we've asked to change the annual report and why we've updated that recommendation with a subsequent resolution.
Mr. Kibizi, I need to take a moment and let the record reflect that we've been joined by Representative Carpenter and Representative Groh at 1:30. And before you continue, we have another question from Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. Yeah, I think the November 15th summary you just gave is probably accurate up until about 2 years ago, but I think we've changed the laws since then. Now we have our elections are announced after November 15th, so I don't know that we can still say that we'll actually know who the legislators are at that time. I know in several races, including my own, it wasn't until, you know, December, sometimes late December, before that information was known.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I can only assure you that we would make sure that when an election is ultimately decided, we'd make sure the new legislator was informed of it.
Thank you.
Please continue.
So Representative Fox introduced HB 48, and during those hearings, we found out that there was other people that wanted this change, namely the Legislative Affairs Agency, because we are the only agency that sends its annual reports via hard copy to the library, and the library doesn't want to be in the distribution chain. And Representative Allard asked, well, can we find a way to save money if we removed the printing requirement? We don't spend a lot of money on printing. We print kind of the minimum that makes economic sense. We usually get like 200 printed. And it's like $500 to have those printed. But the commission has no qualms with removing the printing requirement. And so that is reflected in the updated recommendation. So that we would make the electronic copy available on our website and notify the governor and the legislature that it is available. Now, we may still end up printing some because we do have people that want hard copies, and when we go to do outreach events, it is convenient to have hard copies of things to hand out to people. So we may still end up printing them. But quite frankly, the electronic delivery makes a lot of sense, and that it takes paper off of your desks as legislators as well. That's what I got on the annual report. All right, moving on. Nonprofit jurisdiction. Right now, there is a hole in jurisdiction. If you are a smaller nonprofit operating outside the municipality of Anchorage, you can effectively discriminate against your employees with impunity. So the EEOC has jurisdiction over nonprofits if they have at least 15 employees. And the Anchorage Equal Rights Commission has jurisdiction over nonprofits in the municipality of Anchorage. But I mean, if your first job out of high school is working as an admin and you face sexual harassment at a small nonprofit, you essentially have no recourse. You, in theory, could go file a private civil lawsuit. The problem with that is, let's say, you quit, right? You're sick of being sexually harassed at work. Your boss is always making comments about your body. You're touching your butt or something. And you quit. That's a constructive discharge. You go talk to a private attorney. You go file a lawsuit. You've got a righteous case. But you got another job within 2 or 3 weeks, maybe making $1 an hour more. What are your damages? Your damages are going to be 3 weeks back pay, which is going to be a couple of $1,000s. And if an attorney wants $5,000 as a retainer to even walk in the door, you're not going to end up going anywhere with your case. But that is exactly the kind of case that the Human Rights Commission can and does take. And because we are a government agency, it doesn't cost the victim of discrimination anything to bring a case to us. So the statutory exclusion for nonprofits removes many employers from ASHRAE's jurisdiction. So looking at data from 2021, there are 5,620 nonprofits in the state. 78% of those are 501c3s. Only 25% of those are religious. Now, there's certainly going to be First Amendment protections, and in both our regulation and in updated legislation that we have proposed, there are explicit carve-outs in the affirmative defense we have recently asked for that would articulate that if you are an employer that has people providing ecclesiastical services, that you've got an affirmative defense here, and the Human Rights Commission can't do anything about it. But these nonprofits provide 38,105 direct jobs and represent $2.8 billion in employee wages and salaries. Nonprofits are the third largest industry behind oil and gas and seafood. And of those, healthcare is the largest field by far, with 20,366 employees. Nonprofits generated $7.84 billion in revenue in 2020. 74% of that revenue was healthcare-related revenue. Now, ASHRAE routinely receives referrals from the EEOC. So we have a contract with the EEOC. We are what's called a Fair Employment Practices Agency. So it's AERC, and there are large municipalities in basically every state has some equivalent of us, where if a case ends up being co-jurisdictional for both the EEOC and ASHRAE, the EEOC sends the case to us to do the investigation. And then even if we close it, no substantial evidence, as long as we've done some work on the case, we get $800 from the EEOC. And so we have the potential to capture additional federal revenue if we're able to get nonprofit jurisdiction. We do not track our non-jurisdictional inquiries when we get a direct call from a victim of discrimination and they say they work for a nonprofit. It's simply a non-jurisdictional case for us. So I can't tell you how many of these cases we've simply turned down. For 90% of our filings are employment-related filings. So it would capture certainly a number of cases that we'd be able to get $800 per case. Any questions on nonprofit jurisdiction?
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Sue, the Chair. The example you were talking about earlier about someone who's, basically only stands to gain 3 weeks of back pay. Is it that if they come to the commission, they stand to get more than that? Or is it just the fact that you can provide effectively pro bono legal services, which saves them having to go find a pro bono attorney if they, you know, aren't in a position to afford it.
Representative Eastman, through the chair, I don't want to say that we effectively provide pro bono services because we kind of do. We do not have an attorney-client relationship with our complainants. We have an ex rel relationship. So to the extent that the complainant's interest is aligned with state policy, then we go forward together with Asher kind of taking the lead. Complainants are certainly allowed to still go retain their own attorneys, even in the complainant realm, while Asher is taking a case. And some complainants do in fact do that. We have the authority to obtain make whole relief, which is effectively compensatory damages.
Thank you, Paula. And what is the definition of employee that the commission relies on?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, that is codified and is 18-8300, subsection 4. Employee means an individual employed by an employer, but does not include an individual employed in the domestic service of the person. And subsection 5, employer means a person, including the state and a political subdivision of the state, who has one or more employees in the state, but does not include a club that is exclusively social or fraternal, charitable, educational, or religious association or corporation, if the club, association, or corporation is not organized for private profit. Those are the two current definitions of those two.
And I'm still looking for what the substance of employee means. That definition you just says it has somebody that's employed. So what is the definition of employed?
We'd use a common definition. We'd go look at Webster's.
Okay. Follow up? So would a volunteer be considered employed under some circumstances?
Representative Eastman, through the chair, no, a volunteer would not be considered an employee.
Follow up? And if you have an individual who is reimbursed for travel expenses as a volunteer, would they be considered employed?
Mr. Kibizi, there you go. Your microphone was
muted. Sorry. I had my microphone muted. Representative Eastman through the chair, I didn't hear any of that. If you could speak a little more loudly and clearly through the microphone. I think part of it is because I had an airplane flying overhead.
We were wondering what that was.
Yes. So a volunteer who is reimbursed for expenses, say travel expenses or per diem or something like that, do they fall into the volunteer definition or do they fall into the employee definition?
Representative Eastman through the chair, that would still be a volunteer.
Thank you.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm following off of Representative Eastman's line of questioning. We have in our supporting documents resolution 2022-4, and on the second page of that, it says that you're resolving that an employer means a person, including the state and a political subdivision of the state, who has one or more employees in the state, but does not include an organization or club that is exclusively social or fraternal, is not organized for private profit. And I'm just curious, is what's happening in Section 7 of this bill fulfilling your intention from that resolution? We can't hear you.
Mr. Cabizier, your microphone is muted again.
That's because I'm muted. I'm sorry. I'm trying to juggle with 737s flying overhead. Representative Gray through the chair. No, it doesn't. We've been trying to wordsmith this back and forth and look at an analysis the Ledge Legal had done for Representative Joseph, who introduced HB 13. And we've just come up with newer language. I wanted myself and a couple of attorneys here to sit on that for a few days. And so we sent that both to Representative Josephson and Representative Vance this morning. And let me read you our updated recommendation. We are asking that employer in AS 1883-100 essentially be the language that we've got in the resolution stating that employer means a person, including the state or any political subdivision of the state who has one or more employees in the state. Employer does not include an organization that is exclusively social or fraternal and is not organized for private profit. So that encompasses all nonprofits, unless you're a fraternity or just a club. So if you're a fraternity and you want it to be a Jewish-only fraternity, that would be authorized. If you want to be the KKK, you could be the KKK and have a race component of your organization and still be not organized for private profit. That is, I'd argue, is a social club. Now, we are asking that in unlawful employment practices under AS 1882-20, which is our jurisdiction for employment cases, we add in an affirmative defense. So we're asking you to add in a subsection E now. And it would state, in any action brought under A1 of this section, it is an affirmative defense that, one, the employer is a religious corporation, association, educational institution, or society with respect to the employment of individuals of a particular religion to perform work connected with the carrying on by such corporation, association, educational institution, or society of its activities. And two, the employee is an individual hired to engage in activities that are ecclesiastical, spiritual, or religious, and whose job responsibilities include furthering the study or advancement of religion. So the first prong of that literally comes directly as a copy and paste out of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. Subsection 2 of that is kind of a combination of two cases, partly in a definition from Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. So when we had our meetings, I met with Senator Hughes. And Senator Hughes expressed to me her concern that if you had four Jewish moms that wanted to get together and form a daycare and have as a component of their daycare a religious instruction, that they should be able to discriminate and not only hire other Jewish moms to work in there. As a legal analysis, that would be protected under the First Amendment. There is other case law that basically says religions get to decide who their ministers are, which can go down to lay people, obviously, so long as they are involved in some capacity providing religious instruction. And so we think this affirmative defense takes care of Senator Hughes's concern. And it complies with the First Amendment and the ministerial exceptions.
Follow up. So if you were working for like a Catholic nonprofit and it were discovered that you were Jewish and they said, well, we have to let you go now, because we didn't realize you were Jewish and we only hire Christians. Would that be something that you couldn't take up? That would be something that's outside your jurisdiction. You'd be like, well, we don't really cover that. You were working for a Catholic organization. If they discovered you were Jewish and they don't want you to continue your work, then, that's the risk you took. You shouldn't have taken a job with a Catholic organization. Am I understanding it correctly?
Representative Gray, through the chair, in part. So if they're a Catholic organization, they would still have to be a corporation, association, educational institution, or society with respect to the employment of individuals of a particular religion to perform work connected with the carrying on of that entity's activities. So, and the second component is the employee would have to be involved in some kind of ecclesiastical services. So, I mean, if you had a parochial school and the parochial school has a janitorial position, and within the janitorial position, the duties are only related to cleaning the floors and cleaning the bathrooms, that position would not get the affirmative defense because that individual is not hired to engage in activities that are ecclesiastical, spiritual, or religious. And the job responsibilities do not further the study or advancement of religion. There is federal case law that says essentially there was a parochial school teacher who was fired and claimed that the parochial school was covered by Title VII Civil Rights Act. And the court essentially found that, well, because the parochial school is certainly an arm of the church, and the duties of the teacher include praying with the students and leading prayers and bringing the students to the chapel for service, that even though the teacher's duties are for education, part of their duties were ecclesiastical, spiritual, or religious. And so we would want to look at what is the job description, what is the function of this person in the entity, in addition to what is the entity.
Follow up.
So
I want to ask one more quick follow up about this, and then I want to expand it and ask about non-religious entities. But for the sake of this moment, I'll just use my own personal life story. I worked as a professional singer in my early 20s. I worked as a soloist at an Episcopal church, at a Baptist church, and I did sing for the Jewish High Holy Days at synagogues. No one asked me what my religion was, so I did all of them. But if any of them had said, we've learned that you're not Jewish, or we've learned that you're not Baptist, or we've learned that you're not Episcopal, then they would say, we're going to have to let you go. That would be a case because I was singing in the service. That would mean that they would have the right to tell me that I could no longer do that job.
Representative Gray, through the chair, I believe that would be, they would be entitled to the affirmative defense. So subsection E1 of our new proposed language would be, yes, that employer is definitely a religious association. And I would state that, yeah, if you were hired, you were an employee, you were paid to sing, I think that they've got a strong argument that singing religious songs is part of the ecclesiastical, spiritual, or religious function of that job that furthered the advancement of the religion. So I think that they would be entitled to the protection, and that they could terminate you for that reason, for not being a member of that faith.
Follow up. So when I look at section 7, I just want to make sure I understand, because we've talked, I feel like I have a good handle on the religious part, but like a food bank, is a food bank required, is a food bank covered by the Alaska State Commission for Human Rights? I mean, if a food bank says that we're only going to hire men, this job requires heavy lifting. This food bank only hires men to carry these pallets of food. Would a woman be covered or no? If they were not allowed to do that job or weren't hired or.
Representative Gray, through the chair. So a food bank is the kind of thing that we looked at again after providing the language that is in Section 7 right now. And that's one of the reasons why we think that Section 7 as currently written does not do what we want.
Follow up. What do you want?
So we have provided updated language to Representative Vance as well as Representative Josephson. We want employer under 188300, the definition of employer, to state essentially what is in the original draft of the resolution. And then we want to add a new subsection E under AS 188220, which is the jurisdiction, which is the statute that gives us jurisdiction over employment practices, that creates an affirmative defense for those religious entities who hire an employee that has ecclesiastical duties.
Follow up. But employees who did non-ecclesiastical duties, like you spoke about before, like a custodian, would be covered. They would have protection under the law
Representative Gray, through the chair, under our new proposed language, that is correct. If the employee, if their job description did not include ecclesiastical, spiritual, or religious responsibilities or anything furthering the study or advancement of religion, they would be entitled to protections.
Follow up. What if in the job description it added like a small religious thing that you had to begin your day with prayer or something along those lines to make the job ecclesiastical? Would there be a mechanism to make a custodian an ecclesiastical position by adding some language or a duty that required, for example, that they must begin every workday with prayer?
Representative Gray, through the chair, we discussed that internally as well. And we believe that, yes, if a church hired a custodian and said in the custodial duties, you are expected to pray with the children during Sunday school while you're in there cleaning their bathroom, then, or they were required to lead a prayer, or they were provided, required to sit in there for Sunday school, just for Sunday school, even if that was the only non-custodial duty they had, that would give the employer the affirmative defense.
One final follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
What if the requirement was must attend church on Sunday?
Representative Gray, through the chair, I'm not sure.
And they were fired. Perhaps they missed 3 Sundays in a row and they lose their job.
Yeah, Representative Gray, through the chair, I'd have to think about that one. I don't know that they would be entitled to that because they're not furthering the study or advancement of religion necessarily just by attending a service.
Thank you.
I mean, maybe they are. I don't know the answer to that one. I'd have to do further analysis.
Any further questions on section number 7? I think we've covered everything. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not on section 7, but I, through the chair, I thought I heard that with this change, you would be able to pick up additional cases. And I'm not sure where they came from, at $800 per case. Did I hear that correctly? What does a case cost you to manage?
What does a case cost us now? Sorry, through the chair. It depends on the case. I mean, some cases we certainly spend a lot more time on. Some cases we're able to see from the outset, this isn't the case, and we can close those real fast. We get $800 as long as we do some minimal amount of work that we can document to the EEOC. I mean, I could go through and give you an average, but it's going to be based on, an employee's overall, an investigator's overall salary. And then some cases, obviously, all right, there's discrimination here. And so now it's got to move down to the hearing unit and we're going to engage in litigation. So, I mean, I've got one case right now that is in the public accusation phase that I am keeping the case as one of my cases. And I'm in motion practice with opposing counsel right now. So, I mean, now you're paying attorney rates for moving the case on. It depends on the case. Early on, so last year we implemented this resolutions conference process. So we're requiring respondents and complainants to come into our office early on in the case or over Zoom and sit down and give us all their data, give us all their information. What are your defenses? We want to try and narrow the issues down, bring it, tell us who all of your witnesses are and what are they going to say? So, the very first one of these that we sat down and did, the complainant sat down. It was a claim of disability employment discrimination. The employee gave us the medical documentation, and it was immediately clear to us the employee did not have a qualifying disability. And so, all right, this is a case where even if this resolutions conference fails and they do not come to a settlement agreement through our pseudo-mediation, we have a record that we can defend on an appeal. And so we have the ability to immediately close that case. Now, much to my dismay, the employer wanted to settle the case anyway because there was also an outstanding workman's comp claim and a district court case. And so the employer was thrilled to have this process and the opportunity to sit down and get a signed release, get both of those other issues resolved. And he wrote a moderate and small check to the complainant to make all of this go away. So, you know, we're going to get $800 for that case. If we closed it that way with a settlement agreement, if we closed it with a no substantial evidence determination and we knew we had a record that we could withstand, or if we had, you know, finished the investigation in some other way and found substantial evidence and went to trial and did full-blown litigation, we were going to get $800 no matter what.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems like to me this is we're taking an $800 payment, spending $1,000, but we're going to make it up in volume. I mean, I'm not sure that $800 does much. And I'm not sure you want to take those additional cases. I mean, do you have extra people laying around that you can do this? And $800 is significant, is sufficient to pay for these cases? I mean, it doesn't seem like a lot of money for what could be a lot of work.
Representative Johnson, through the chair, we've got the capacity to do it within our existing budget. Our caseload, number one, this is something the commission has been asking for many, many years. Number two, I admit our caseload fell off a cliff with COVID. People weren't being employed. If you're not employed, you're not complaining of discrimination. And even as COVID kind of let off, and people who did have jobs during COVID wanted to keep those jobs, and they were afraid of complaining about discrimination because of potential retaliation. And even as COVID let off, we had what was called the Great Resignation, where people who were in jobs that they were not finding satisfying and could be because of discrimination, they just quit because it was easier to go down the street and find a better paying job and better circumstances that they liked. We have the capacity to take the cases. And this could end up being a reduce of our draw on the general fund. I mean, either way, we bring in additional federal receipts. And some of these cases, we don't end up spending a lot of time on. Most of our cases, we end up closing with no substantial evidence. Somebody gets fired because they screwed up at work and they internalize there's got to be some other reason that I made a mistake. It's because of my sex. It's because of the color of my skin. And so they come to the Human Rights Commission, and if they articulate a jurisdictional case, by law, we are required to take it.
Follow up.
And then we do the investigation and we find out, no, there was a non-discriminatory reason for the employment action. Your employer recorded you taking money out of the till. That's a non-discriminatory reason for your termination. And we end up backing the employer's decision.
Follow up, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you offered that you could get us an average cost of the case. Could you provide that to the committee? And before our next hearing, I would like to see what the average case costs, because I don't want to take money from the feds just to have to spend more money. And I think my logic should be clear. So if you'd provide that to the chair, I'd appreciate it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Groh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have some questions about the proposed legislation as well in terms of changes to the definition of employer. Sir, would the proposed legislation protect a religious charity organization that pays lower wages to employees of a specific national origin, even if they have similar qualifications as other employees?
Representative Groh, through the chair, that would be discrimination. Absolutely. I mean, we could do that now for private entities, for for-profit entities. With what we are asking for, that would now be covered for nonprofits as well, who are discriminating against minorities based on pay.
Okay.
Right now, we can't touch nonprofits for any employment matter.
Okay. Let's assume that there's a worker for a religious corporation and that worker breaks their knee in a random accident, becomes disabled. The employer now decides it's too expensive to pay for the insurance for their care and fire them. Is that act protected by this law, this proposed law?
Representative Groh, through the chair, if the employer is a religious association and the employee is hired for ecclesiastical, spiritual, or religious purposes, then the employer would be entitled to the affirmative defense under the language that you don't have in front of you that we're now asking for. And so, no, they could terminate that employee because of the disability.
Okay.
Yes,
please. I'm just going to go with another hypothetical. Could the change in the definition of an employer allow a religious child care center to legally refuse to hire an applicant with a speech impediment, even if the employee was qualified and capable of hiring and caring for children?
Representative Groh, through the chair, under the new language that we have proposed, that is correct. They could refuse to hire the employee for any reason.
Okay. Thanks.
Any further questions for Mr. Corbusier on the merits of the bill? Thank you so much for walking us through this. And yes, any further comments?
We got one more big section.
Oh, my apologies.
So the last issue is a for cause removal provision. So this was introduced at the request of Commissioner William Craig, who said at the beginning of his term on the commission in at the very beginning of 2019, he was one of the governor's natural appointments as opposed to filling a vacancy, an artificial vacancy. He said there was a commissioner who staff had complained had just gone incognito. It just disappeared. It ghosted the agency. And the Commissioner Craig was like, well, why can't you remove them? How do we remove a commissioner who's just being neglectful? And then subsequent to that, the governor removed several commissioners through the Black Rifles Matter sticker controversy. And the governor has removed a couple of commissioners since then as well. And Commissioner Craig believes, and the rest of the commission fully supports, that there should be a for-cause removal provision. Our legislative history is kind of scant, and we don't think that the legislature intended for the Human Rights Commission commissioners to be at-will appointments of the governor. We need to remain an apolitical entity. We are a quasi-judicial entity. We have jurisdiction over the legislature. We have jurisdiction over the governor. We've got jurisdiction over the court system. I should say the governor's office. We've got jurisdiction over all private employers in the state. And if we were just to become a series of appointments and a political arm of whatever administration happens to be in there, the agency could be weaponized to just simply go after political enemies. And we think that is why the statute was set up, so that the seats are in 5-year rotating terms and there are 7 commissioners. And in theory, no single governor can appoint the entirety of the commission. The commission wants to make clear that this is not trying to poke a thumb in the eye of the governor. They are all appointees of the current governor. But from what they've seen, they think that there should be a for-cause removal provision. We essentially copied and pasted what was in the AOGCC removal statute. We punched it up with one phrase in there. But it gives a due process right for the commissioners to be removed. And so if a commissioner does believe they're being removed for political reasons, they've got the opportunity to defend themselves and present evidence in a tribunal to counter that. So the commissioners have asked for a for-cause removal provision. to give the governor an explicit tool for a process to remove commissioners in the future.
Representative Eastman, do you still have a question?
Thank you, through the chair. I think the language you're recommending on pages 1 and 2 of the bill is public or private actions that undermine the commission's work. And there's some other things, but I'm just highlighting that portion of it. What is it that would be a public or private action that undermines the commission's work?
I mean, let's say I've got Representative Eastman through the chair. Let's say there's a commissioner who is also an employer, and they are violating the law by discriminating against an employee. That could be a private action that undermines the commission's work and violates the chapter.
Follow up? Yeah, no, I'm not talking about the violating the chapter part. I get that. I'm talking about the substance before the or, which is be not violating the chapter part, the public or private actions that undermine the commission's work. What else are we trying to wrap up in that? Because that seems quite broad. Private action undermines the commission's work. Is that a commissioner that takes a minority view and consistently votes against the majority's position on policies or cases? Is it someone who wants the commission to take a different direction on priorities and policies? And now,
Representative Eastman, you're away from the microphone. I can't hear you.
Yeah, we'll blame that on the airplane. Is that someone who is consistently wanting the commission to go a different direction, either in priorities or policies or accepting different cases or so forth? But how do we define the scope of undermine the commission's work? What is there a definition somewhere, or how should we understand that?
That's one of those things that I think is open to interpretation. And Representative Eastman through the chair, I think that could be open to interpretation, but it would also give the commissioner who is being targeted the opportunity to, again, publicly defend themselves in a tribunal if they are being attacked for what could be arguably policy differences related to politics.
Follow up. And what is the tribunal you're referring to? What does that consist of? And is that something that you can sit in on as a voter or not? How does that work?
Representative Eastman through the chair. So again, we looked at the AOGCC statute because that was the one that was most recently tested with the removal of Hollis French. And in that case, and I believe that was the first time that that had been tested itself, but there was a third-party hearing officer that was retained by the Office of the Governor. The Department of Law conducted an investigation, and evidence was presented in front of the hearing officer. And Hollis French, as a commissioner, had the opportunity, and I believe he did retain counsel, and presented in the tribunal counter-evidence. The hearing officer then looked at the charges, wrote up findings, and presented those to the Office of the Governor. That is the precedent, and I would assume that the governor's office would take a similar tactic to implement this section if the legislature decides to pass it.
Follow up.
Thank you. And again, as a member of the public, do I have access to come in and sit on those proceedings? Are they available to a voter to observe?
Representative Eastman, through the chair, there's nothing that makes this provision confidential. It is not an action that I think would fall within an executive session under the Open Meetings Act. And I believe that the Hollis French Tribunal was open to the public. You should not quote me on that.
Okay.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, following up through Representative Eastman's questions, maybe I'm missing it. What line is the word tribunal on?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, tribunal is not specifically in here. That was my term.
Okay.
That was, I mean, when you look at the language, to remove a commissioner for cause, the governor shall provide a copy of the charges to the commissioner and offer an opportunity for the commissioner to be publicly heard in person. It's public. Or by counsel in the commissioner's defense upon not less than 10 days notice. If a commissioner is removed for cause, the governor shall file with the lieutenant governor a complete statement of all charges made against the commissioner and the governor's findings based on the charges, together with a complete record of the proceedings. As lawyers, you know, I see that as an opportunity for a public hearing where you get to present a defense.
Follow up?
And I would call that a tribunal.
Right. So the governor, let's say, says this commissioner has committed misconduct. That person is given the opportunity to publicly defend themselves against misconduct in whatever that looks like. And then who decides if the governor has made the right decision or not? I guess that's the tribunal. Sorry, I just don't understand who's gonna say the governor was wrong. The public?
Representative Gray, through the chair, arguably the public, is a political matter. I mean, my recollection was that Tim Tumenos had been retained. He's a private attorney in private practice. He was retained to be the hearing officer for the Hollis French matter. And there were a number of charges, and Mr. Tumenos did not end up finding that all of the charges had been proven. And he wrote up a report and gave it to the governor. He did find that several of the charges were proven, though. And so the governor elected at that point to go ahead and remove Hollis French. Now, an argument could be made that it was simply politics and you are responsible to the voters as the governor, as the elected official. But these are also gubernatorial appointments subject to legislative confirmation. It's another opportunity for a check and balance on the agency. And to ensure that our work remains politically independent.
Follow up.
And again, I'm just learning here, but I mean, the way the public shows that they disapproved of the governor's findings of misconduct would be through sending emails to the commission or to the governor or calling the governor's office or calling the commission. I'm just curious about how that's tabulated, that the public feels that the findings of misconduct are right or wrong, how the public is able to make that decision.
Representative Gray, through the chair, that would be through expressing their disapproval or approval to the governor's office rather than to the commission.
Okay.
The commission itself, the other commissioners, the employees of the commission, would not be involved in the removal process.
Follow up. Is there any adverse actions that can be taken if the public finds that the governor's accusations of misconduct are improper or without merit?
Representative Gray, through the chair, I mean, I suppose you could add a provision that you could appeal the decision into the Superior Court.
I will need to think about that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
By contrast, Mr. Cavizzi, could you describe how a commissioner is removed from the commission currently?
To the chair, there is no provision in statute either way. And prior to 2019, no commissioner had ever been removed from this agency. And my understanding was that in early 2019, as a result of the controversy with the Black Rifles Matter sticker, the governor's office simply called a couple of the commissioners, I think three or four of the commissioners, and said that their services were no longer needed. There were media reports that those commissioners were surprised to get this notification. There is an argument that a removed commissioner could challenge the governor's decision based on an earlier Alaska case, Bradner v. Hammond. But because the Human Rights Commission commissioners are unpaid volunteers, there is no financial incentive for them to get involved in a court challenge against the governor's office the way there was in Bradner v. Hammond.
Thank you for that. Any further questions for Mr. Cabezier on House Bill 181? Thank you so much for coming. It sounds like you have some other air activity there, but we appreciate just your knowledge on this and insight. Seeing there's no other business before the committee today, we will conclude business. The House Judiciary Committee meeting will meet again on Friday, April 26th at 1 p.m. to have a first hearing on House Bill 29, Insurance Discrimination, by Representative McCabe. We will set House Bill 181 aside. Sounds like we have further revision work to do from the request by the Executive Director and the Commission. Seeing there is no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 2:23 p.m.